Court will proceed to the third case of the day, United States versus Smith and Patterson. Mr. Kamen?
Morning, Your Honor. Scott Kamen for Mr. Patterson. The first point I'd like to address is point number one. The trial court erred in upholding the Mr. Patterson's conspiracy conviction. Basically, the jury acquitted the co-defendant, Smith, of the conspiracy conviction, and the Seventh Circuit and the Supreme Court had basically held in conjunction that, in that situation, the conspiracy conviction of Mr. Patterson cannot be affirmed, and so we've asked to have him acquitted.
The district court presumably gave some reasons for denying the motion for acquittal. Where can we find them?
Well, the trial court found that...
Where can we find them?
Well,
Circuit Rule 30 requires them to be in the appendix to your brief. They weren't in the appendix to your brief, although you filed a certificate under Circuit Rule 30 certifying that the appendix contained all of the materials required by that rule. Your certificate is false. There is such an opinion of the district court actually published. It's in said sup. But you falsely certified that there was no opinion of the district court on this question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Sorry is not the right word. Misrepresentations to a court are serious business.
I'm not sure what I could have done. I did.
You could have told the truth.
Well, I did include it initially in my appendix, but then the clerk explained to me that my appendix was too large. Made me exclude it.
The clerk doesn't make people exclude the district court's opinions. The rule requires it to be included, and there's no length limit on the appendix. But in any event, certifying to the court that the appendix includes all of these materials when it doesn't is, as I say, a deliberate misrepresentation to the court. That's serious business.
The trial court did, in fact, find that there was overwhelming evidence of a conspiracy between Smith and Patterson, and did find in a memorandum opinion, in her memorandum opinion, that there was overwhelming evidence, and I can certainly supply that support. My understanding through the clerk...
We found it. No thanks to you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My understanding was that I was not supposed to provide
that. You are required to provide it. But in any event, as I say, certifying that there was none is not a way out if you don't like what the clerk's office does.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I believe that the case on point is Mancari, and Mancari explains that although the verdicts are inconsistent, and inconsistency, of course, is not enough, but there no longer can be a presumption that if there are only two conspirators and one conspirator is acquitted, that conspirator is acquitted properly. that conspirator may be acquitted lawlessly. And if there's overwhelming evidence of that, of that conspiracy found in the record, then the trial judge can enter a judgment on that verdict. And that, in fact, is what the trial judge did. And I believe the trial judge erred in doing so. And I don't believe that there was overwhelming evidence.
Where does the requirement of overwhelming evidence come from?
The requirement of overwhelming evidence comes from Mancari.
No, it doesn't. Mancari says that when the evidence is overwhelming, the court certainly will not reverse the verdict. What you need is a requirement that unless the evidence is overwhelming, the court will reverse the verdict. Mancari doesn't establish that. Mancari affirmed. Is there any case that, in your view, does establish that?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood it. Unless the evidence is overwhelming.
The difference between necessary and sufficient conditions. It is a sufficient condition to affirm that the evidence is overwhelming. What makes it a necessary condition to affirm that the evidence be overwhelming?
Okay, well, I don't believe that there was sufficient evidence.
I'm not talking about sufficient evidence. Go ahead. If you don't understand the difference between necessary and sufficient conditions, just go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry. I believe that I'm going into my time on rebuttal, and I would like to reserve some of that time.
All right.
Okay, so thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bill Keller.
My name is Peter Vilcalis. I represent Daryl Smith, who is currently incarcerated, serving a 10-year sentence. And it was our position then, and it's our position today, that his sentence should have been more along the lines of 10 months. As the court knows, he was a Chicago policeman. The co-defendant was my client's sergeant. The trial involved and the issues involved the sergeant, Sergeant Patterson, dealing with an gentleman who was an FBI informant who was working off a huge cocaine case himself and was setting up allegedly corrupt Chicago police officers for the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI. The tapes, the audio tapes, and the videotapes, which were recorded by the informant in this case, reflect that the informant told Sergeant Patterson of an easy ripoff of a drug dealer's apartment that would be an easy ripoff. The informant even provided the keys to the apartment to Sergeant Patterson. The only evidence on audio tape suggesting the involvement, the knowing involvement of Officer Smith, was that on one or more occasions, Sergeant Patterson said to the informant, "Smitty is the only one I can trust to do this." However, you don't know if Patterson ever actually had a conversation with Smith wherein Patterson actually told Smith what the object of this escapade was. It's true that Officer Smith, along with Sergeant Patterson, were captured on videotape in this apartment, and Sergeant Patterson rummaged around, and Sergeant Patterson is the one who found the sham cocaine and the money, and then he and Officer Smith left the apartment. And then it's true that Officer Smith, they drove in the police car to the informant's vehicle, where Officer Smith took a garbage bag that contained a gym bag that had the sham cocaine in it, and then Officer Smith put that bag in the informant's vehicle, as he was told to do by Sergeant Patterson.
Are you saying Smith wasn't aware he was engaged in illegal activity?
That's what I'm saying.
Would the tape reflect that as far as the conduct of the two officers in placing the apartment in a state of disarray and the breaking of the lock? Would you say that your client was... his conduct was consistent with not being unaware?
When they were arrested by the FBI later that day at a police station, Sergeant Patterson had in his possession a consent form, a form of some sort that the police fill out indicating that they were going to this address for some legitimate, quote-unquote, police purpose. And then, so A bit of evidence that the government made much ado of was the fact that both Sergeant Patterson and Officer Smith, when they were in the undercover apartment, were masked. And there was testimony from Commander Ernest Brown, who was the commander of these men. He was the commander of the public housing section of the Chicago Police Department. And Mr. Pasquale below asked him, and are officers allowed to wear masks when they go in and do legitimate police raids? And Sergeant and Commander Brown, apparently to the surprise of Mr. Pasquale, said, well, yes, because officers who work in the project, sometimes for a variety of reasons, for security, for psychological advantage, actually do wear ski masks when they do certain types of operations in the project. So, yes, the fact that my client, Officer Smith, was captured on a videotape in an undercover apartment was a problem for him. But his actions were simply his actions. There was no evidence that he and Sergeant Patterson ever reached a meeting of the minds. Our suggestion
is... What about the way they went about staging the state of disarray?
Well, I believe...
Did your client not participate in that or not witness?
Well, my client participated in the search of the apartment. Now, the characterization that it was a staged to make it look like it was in disarray, a viewing of the tape shows that they're not speaking to each other, audibly at least, in the apartment, but Patterson is clearly in control, and he's pointing here, he's pointing there, telling my client where to look and what to do. My client is, he takes in one, there's one part of the tape where it shows my client takes a lamp, a table lamp, looks under it, and then just puts it down. Well, I mean, anybody who's ever seen an apartment after it's been legitimately searched by the Chicago police or by any police know that it's not necessarily left in the same condition it was found. They tend to ransack these places when they're looking for their things. So the mere fact, if I can say that, the mere fact that my client was in the apartment with Sergeant Patterson while a problem for him in terms of the evidence is not dispositive of it, and I believe that that fact was reflected in the fact that the jury acquitted Officer Smith of the conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute the cocaine and the 924C gun count, and they only convicted him, unfortunately, of the theft of government funds, and it's that which brings us here today. He was acquitted on the most serious offenses and found guilty of theft of money. The amount of money that was stolen was $20,000. So if he were to have been sentenced for that which he was convicted, then our position is that the sentencing range, I mean, we could argue about that, but the sentencing range would have been in the 10 to some 16-month range. And instead, it is our opinion and our position that the court below took the government's position and substituted her judgment for that of the jury and sentenced him to the maximum for theft, which was 10 years.
Why wasn't that within the judge's power under United States against Watts?
Well,
where the Supreme Court held that a judge may do exactly that.
Well, there's the issue of the Ring opinion, and in my opinion...
Yeah, but the Supreme Court has said, I think pretty plainly, that courts of appeals are not to deem decisions overruled until the Supreme Court says they're overruled. Ring doesn't purport to overrule Watts.
Well... It doesn't directly say that it overrules Watts, but
it doesn't even mention Watts.
No, sir, it doesn't. But
and therefore, it doesn't overrule it.
Well, sir, but it says that a defendant may not be exposed to a penalty exceeding the maximum he would receive if punished according to the facts reflected in the jury verdict alone. And, I mean, these words, and I they mean something. The facts reflected in the jury's verdict was that he stole $20,000. Now, the government argued it's not...
And the maximum punishment for that offense is...
10 years
in prison, and that's what your client received.
Because they held him responsible for the conspiracy to possess cocaine, and they even disregarded, the government submitted a special jury verdict form to the jury as to what was the amount of drugs involved. And the jurors chose, beyond a reasonable doubt, the middle, not the most, the largest amount of drugs, but a middling amount of drugs. And the court found, no, we find by a preponderance of the evidence that it was actually a higher amount of drugs. And my client, the court's correct, my client's guideline range would have been about 188 months had he been found guilty of all counts, but he was only found guilty of the theft. And we were told that we did good for my client because he only got 10 years. But in our opinion, we didn't do that well for my client because I believe he should have been sentenced to significantly less time. You know, Justice Kennedy recently made some remarks about...
Yeah, your time has expired, and okay. We're aware of Justice Kennedy's remarks to the APA. Are those remarks that you wanted to comment on?
Sure, they sure
were. Yes, I'm sure my colleagues are aware of that. Thank you.
Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. McGovern.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Patrick McGovern on behalf of the United States. Just let me clarify that the only issue on appeal as far as Mr. Smith is concerned is his sentencing, not the underlying conviction. He does raise some issues as to relevant conduct, but as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, under the Watts case, which is still good law, a defendant can still be found guilty by the preponderance of the evidence for relevant conduct, but at the same time acquitted of the same charge. Watts is still good law. Mr. Smith's counsel also points out that his client should have been sentenced arguably for only 10 months. But as he also mentioned, if the guidelines were to apply in this case, Mr. Smith would have been sentenced to 188 months. The fact that he was only sentenced to 10 years certainly can be construed as almost a break to Mr. Smith, that he was maxed out under Apprendi. Let me
track that again. He lucked out in what regard?
Well, I think that
he was acquitted?
He was acquitted.
Yeah, well, when you're acquitted, Mr. McGovern,
yes.
It's very difficult for a district judge to impose a sentence.
That's correct, Your Honor. I didn't mean to be facetious about it, but
he was lucky that he beat what you thought was an overwhelming conspiracy, or is this the case where the government failed to convict somebody of conspiracy?
Your Honor, it could have been either. In our view, the government's view, the evidence was there. There was overwhelming evidence. We, of course, cannot speculate to what the jury the jury's verdict was. They may have done it out of sympathy, as Mr. Patterson's argument addresses. We cannot speculate on what the jury found. Although we do know that Judge Bucklow did find that the evidence was overwhelming against Mr. Smith. Of course, that doesn't take away the fact that he was indeed acquitted by the jury. And to address Mr. Patterson's argument, I think Judge Easterbrook already has that. Mancari, this court's opinion in Mancari, simply reaffirms or restates the rule from the Supreme Court's decision in Powell that inconsistent verdicts can stand and that the only standard is the sufficiency of the evidence. And the evidence was sufficient in this case against Mr. Smith regardless. He was caught on video at the apartment. He was out of his district. He was wearing a mask. He put the bag with the sham cocaine into the Tahoe after the burglary occurred, and he is on. There's a number of phone records in this case indicating that he and Mr. Patterson had conversations right after Mr. Patterson discussed the proposed ripoff with Mr. Beal. There are no other questions from Your Honors. I will just conclude and ask Your Honors to affirm the conviction of Mr. Patterson and the sentence of Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Government. Is there any rebuttal time? 4 minutes left, Mr. Kamen.
Just briefly on the evidence of conspiracy. Although, I mean, there were the phone conversations, but the phone conversations, there was no mention of the drugs in the conversations, and although he took a package, there's no evidence that he knew what was in the packages. There was no direct contact between him and Mr. Beal, who did have conversations with Mr. Patterson about indicating that there would be drugs involved in this, break-in into the apartment. And so there wasn't evidence that Smith was involved. that Smith had knowledge, and so that Smith and Patterson there would be knowledge that Smith was involved in the conspiracy, that there would be overwhelming evidence that there was a conspiracy, narcotics conspiracy. The other point I wanted to address was the gun charge, the gun conviction.
I thought that was in there for sort of comic relief, the notion that because police officers are required to carry guns on duty, therefore the gun wasn't used in connection with the crime. He wasn't really on duty when he's committing a robbery, is he? Committing a burglary?
Well, he was on duty.
Well, I could think that would be interpreted saying, no, if you're going to commit a crime, you're not authorized, you're not required to carry your gun while you're committing a crime. That would be a very odd rule for the police department to have, wouldn't it?
Yeah, actually, what's happening at the very same time is that Mr. Patterson is losing his pension because his conduct was committed while he was on duty. So, I mean, if he wasn't on duty while he had been convicted of the felony, then he wouldn't lose his pension.
He should have filled out his time slip saying, "Don't pay me for the time when I commit crimes."
I mean, when you say comic relief, I'm not sure what. Right, I'm not sure whether he was. I'm not sure how to
determine. Just in what little time we have passed, let go of the comic relief and go forward with other arguments you have.
Well, I mean, he did have it at his side. He was required to carry it at his side. If he was Neil was very close friends with a firefighter and needed a firefighter to be involved, the firefighter was required to wear a helmet, and to make it believable he wears his coat and his hat, then, you know, so that he's on his fire engine. Yeah, then, I mean, you penalize him for wearing his hat. I mean, he didn't, you know, the hat's not at the scene. He's not using it to further, you know, to threaten people at the scene. You know, hey, I've got this hat, I can hit you with the hat. I mean, he didn't use it. He didn't threaten to use it. It wasn't to be used. I mean, he was a police officer. He was required to carry it. I mean, it was the same as having a badge on. It was the same as having polished shoes on. I mean, it was just something that was required, that was in the manual, that had to be there. It's not something that was, as I said, it's not something that was used or threatened to be used.
What was the sentence for your client, Ms. Kim?
Yeah, he was sentenced to, I believe, 295 months.
Thank you, Mr. Kim.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.